Welcome to the Industry 4.0 podcast with Grantech.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of the Industry 4.0 podcast with Grantech. Industry 4.0 podcast with Grantech delivers a look into the world of manufacturing with a focus on stories and trends to lead you to better solutions and outcomes. My name is Dave McKenna. I'm Smart Packaging Solution Leader at Grantech, and today I'm joined by Doug Yerger. Doug is one of our principal engineers at Grantech, and he has over 30 years' experience architecting, designing, actually implementing, commissioning, supporting PLC control systems, robots, vision systems, databases, MES, warehouse management, SCADA, HMI, and Doug's a leader in the company. He provides, as principal engineer, he provides governance, he provides technical direction, and helps us handle technology change and new ideas and movement in the industry. Doug also helps with the HMI and SCADA standards committees, ISA 101 and 112, and is part of the International Society of Automation, the ISA. So very happy to have you on the call, Doug.
Thank you, Dave.
Awesome. So before we get started, I'd like to ask guests kind of their story. How did you get into this wonderful world of manufacturing automation that we're in? Where'd you start? Why are you still doing it? Why are you still doing it? Kind of how'd you get where you are, and what's the story?
Well, it actually started a long, long time ago, back in 1989, when I was a co-op student back in college. I was working with General Motors, and one of my assignments, I was working in plant engineering, and they said, why don't you go ahead and go over in our training center and take the PLC 2 and 3 training courses. So I took those, and our plant actually was an Allen Bradley training center. Like, we had got certified as that, so I got Allen Bradley certificates for PLC 2s and 3s from the training center, and it just kind of stuck with it from there and grew. Even when I went back to get my master's, it was with an emphasis on control theory and things like that, and I've just stuck with it over the years.
Awesome. PLC 2 I've sort of heard of, and I think there was one food and beverage customer that was still running them. It's 2023 now, but they were running them 5 years ago, and maybe they still are. PLC 3, I never heard. I mean, everyone's heard of, well, many people have heard of fives, and there's still lots of fives out there. 3, I haven't heard. What's it? I mean, it's just a PLC, I guess, but 3, was that some exclusive
3 was
General Motors thing or something? Or?
No, it was. I'll say widely available, it was a much larger one. It had more memory, though the memory cost a fortune even back in those days.
Got it.
For it. The cards on the main rack, like the memory cards, were a foot square, at least. They were huge. So it was a very large format on the main one, and then it still used the standard 1771 IO for all of its IO racks. Okay.
I love those old PLCs, and when you picked up a chassis with some stuff in it, you really knew they're heavy. If you've never worked with older control systems, they're heavy. The chassis are like solid metal. The cards have a whole bunch of metal in them, and they're just bigger and heavier and taller, and they don't just snap in with some little flimsy. That's one thing I like. When you put those things in and then snap down the lock piece and whatever in it, it was metal and solid, and that thing's not falling out. You could turn the panel upside down and shake it and nothing's moving on it. So,
and so were the programming terminals.
Awesome. Well, is that like those like suitcase kind of?
It was even before the suitcase ones. It was like a fixed screen with the keyboard on it, and they were monsters.
Awesome. 1989, like an Apple. Well, like an Apple II. I'm trying to remember Apple II, because that was sort of my vintage Oregon Trail sort of Psy-esque. Awesome. If you haven't seen any of this stuff, if you're a younger person, or you got into manufacturing later, or you're at a facility that doesn't have 30 or 40 year old PLCs still running the place, take a look. They're kind of interesting what this stuff is, and built to last, I think, was another. I don't know that I know some of the slick 505s, which were kind of around when I started, are starting to fail just from age and heat and chips falling apart over time. But a lot of this PLC 5 stuff is still going, which is incredible. And I don't think anything, I wonder if the new, I mean, what's your thought? Is Control Logics, is it going to last? Can you run a, I don't know, 55, 61 or a 71 or whatever? Do you think those are going to be physically still okay in 20 years, 30 years, like some of the PLC 5 stuff is? Or
I think if there's, my biggest concern isn't even around dust or dirt. It's more around if there's drastic heat changes, that the plastics are going to fatigue quicker than a lot of the, like you said, there was a lot of metal in the chassis and support structures where now a lot of it's all plastic based. So I think you might have some more issues with the plastics fatiguing more and cracking from heat changes than actual degradation of the equipment.
I was always scared some of the time to, and not all the time in my career. I did get over it and got better at it, but just popping cards in and out, I was like, oh, this thing feels like if I'm leaning on it the wrong way, I'm gonna snap it. But never actually did. But enough history kind of piece. Do you have anything you want to mention? Any events coming up? Any releases? Any exciting anything our guests should kind of know about? Any announcements?
I'm kind of excited with the fact that the ISA 112 committee will be releasing their first official copy of the SCADA standard. It's slated to be this fall, but I suspect it'll be definitely by first quarter next year. So
for anyone who's sort of not as familiar with 112, maybe they never got past 111 or 110 in their ISA reading list. What is ISA 112?
It's a brand new standard. It hasn't been published before. It's covering SCADAs. And as opposed to, if people are familiar with 101, which is the HMIs and high performance graphics, it's more on the design life cycle and structure of the SCADA system. Not getting into screen level design. It's into the architecture design, the life cycle, like I said, what should be testing and qualifications and things like that. Like it's all around that higher level portion of it and saying what a SCADA system is supposed to do, not how to do it.
Got it. And mapping out your plan for a SCADA system, your standards to map out how you plan and set up your SCADA system more than your, is that sort of close? Yep. Okay.
Yeah, that's very close. It's there is a website already for it. Like the system is up there at the ISA.org. You can just search for 112 and it'll bring up you can find the publication page there on what's going to describe the standard.
Perfect. Okay. Well, I recommend folks and making a new for forays into SCADA, check it out. 101, if for people who don't know about it, high performance graphics is, well, and Doug can correct me if I embarrassingly get this wrong, is around how do you lay out, what do you make your screens look like so that your operators can be at high performance? It's about how do you convey information to them clearly and quickly and only convey what they need to know versus some of our favorite, one of my favorite HMIs. It did not meet the ISA 101 standard, but it had some AGVs on it and they didn't move or anything, but it would show vehicles that were at a plant. And when there was a fault from the vehicle, it would animate flipping on its side and then flames would come up and then it would flip back. And that was a board maintenance person's little bit of fun, but
yep.
But yeah, how do you just tell people what they need?
The 101 standard was desperately needed back in the day because as we got HMI displays that could display those graphics, no one went to the should we display those graphics. So we got new animation tools, so we animated everything. We added flames and bubbles and everything else. And it's like, what is that really helping the operator to know? The term they like to use is situational awareness. Like they should be able to walk to HMI and immediately know, Am I running in spec or not? Like everything that draws the operator's attention should be things that aren't normal. If it's normal, it should not be drawing the operator's attention.
Yeah. And I guess making it look like a video game does not, well, it looks cool. It's not the point. It's not for the operator. It doesn't help them know what's
that's,
going
on. That's why you see a lot of the very muted colors. There's lots of grays and whites and blacks for normal states, because color's what's drawing your attention. And if you look at some old HMIs when everything was blue backgrounds and everything on the screen was colored and all that, it was just an assault on your senses to try and figure out what's going on.
I guess the alternate title for ISA 101 would have been 50 Shades of Gray, but maybe that was too, maybe that was too
a little
much
too early for that.
Too much for the automation community. And
well, we only had 8 bits when we started.
Okay. 8 bits of gray. There you go. You can pass that along to them and see if they use that. So first question I always like to ask, and getting to the Industry 4.0 title of our podcast here, what does it mean to you? It's a broad term. It covers everything from 3D printing to data lakes and everything else in between. What does it mean to you? What's Industry 4.0?
Yeah, and I know usually when people start throwing around a bunch of buzzwords and talking Industry 4.0, I often am rolling my eyes, because it's people doing that, just throwing around buzzwords and terms. And it's like, but what are you trying to achieve? And the way I look at Industry 4.0, because some people will be, oh, it's integrating like your ERP systems down to the plant floor. And I look back at it and go, well, back in the day, we could do that from mainframes over data highway to PLC 2s and 3s. So it's not what can we do with that. It's more making it easy to do, quick to do, and eliminating the, oh, there's months worth of engineering to get these systems to all talk to each other, and we've got to get teams on both sides working together to get it all hammered out. And it's to make it it's getting it so things can be done quickly and efficiently, and using one of the terms I hate, the unified namespace, of being able to say, okay, we're going to publish at the lowest level and get the data in that structure all the way up through everything, where we don't have to redefine an interface each time and remap the data at each point along the way. So those are like, that's what I look at. A lot of the big push for Industry 4.0 is, I know we do have a little talk later on, but one of the things I'm really looking forward to it is actually the virtual assistance type thing, where when they're at a machine, tablet knows where it's at, it knows it's by the machine, it can show the faults and show on a layout where those faults are occurring and give possible solutions and direct access to the manuals for what's going on, like where we can have. I see that as a big part of like Industry 4.0 as well, is that streamlining data, not because we've had all that data before. It was just, oh, I gotta go walk over to that HMI and look it up, and then I've got to go find the manual wherever it is. But it's streamlining it, getting people's hands so they can use it very quickly and very efficiently.
I think you got a good point that this has been done. A lot of the data piece has been done. Now, maybe everyone didn't do it. It was some of the leading manufacturers or places that had bigger budgets and bigger IT teams and or OT teams that could kind of handle that. To your point, it's just more of this coming than ever before, and more flexibility in it. So it's not this rigid system. I mean, I also did a point-based ERP to plant floor system in 2003, and it had all the data going up and down between plant floor and MES plant floor and ERP. And so in some ways you're right, this isn't new, but now more people can do it, more accessible, lower cost, more flexibility, and better. I think tying the data and the ERP piece with your point about operators and assistant, and I want to ask a little more about that one, or what you've seen, is better tools to do some of this stuff. So it wasn't like better tools, sorry, to take that data or that information and make it more accessible. I mean, things like Power BI, which I'm a huge fan of. You had all this data before, but what could you really do with it? What could a business person do with it? Not just some super data scientist. I mean, yes, they can do we want them to doing great stuff too, but more business accessible information, operator accessible information. And so are you seeing that kind of, are you seeing penetration of tablets and to sites? Is it, how many, is it useful? What are some of the use cases that you see on that?
Before I jump into that question, I do want to point out, I loved your thing in there, because one of the big problems with these early systems was it was very big on getting data, but not information.
Yep.
And now it's the, we need to get information in people's hands. And that's, with ISA 101, that's one of the big things, is putting a temperature that's something 75 degrees on the screen doesn't tell you anything. Like, you need context, whether upper and lower limits, maybe a spark line or something to say where, what your trends are. Like, you need information about everything. Data is not valuable by itself.
And the data, I think the data stuff before with ERP to plant flora was, ERP needs this. Hey, we need to know how many kilos of X we're producing, because we need to update inventory, because we need the finances correct in our plant, and we need our finished good case count loaded into ERP, because there's millions of dollars per day at stake on getting that wrong or having that late and so on. So I think those were some of the connection points. But now it's, you know, what can we get that's useful for operators and others to run the equipment, keep the equipment going. So the tablets, where, how many, what use cases?
What I've been seeing, a lot of them, the places I've been seeing them so far, which is not where I'm hoping for that virtual assistant, but I've seen them a lot for input devices. Instead of having a fixed terminal somewhere where the operators all have to go over to put in their data, if an operator is known to be mobile and going around, especially like someone on a lift truck, supervisor walking around that has a fairly big area, instead of saying, oh, well, to go and put something in, you've got to walk back over here. It's get something in his hand that he can use wherever he's at, mm-hmm. and make it useful. Those have been the big first push I see. And I think that's a great use case, because it's freeing the person up. It's making it highly utilized right to start from, because it's making their jobs easier. And it's bridging that fear of people. There's been a lot of fear in the manufacturing industry of having tablets on the floor, of they're going to be easy to break, they're going to walk and disappear from being stolen, they're going to get lost. There's like all these fears around it, where people have been trying to hold back from doing it. But now that we're seeing benefits of having it out there with that hurdle gone, and of course, always lowering costs of entry, going on with the tablet realm, it's making it a lot more convenient to get those things out on the floor. And we're seeing it more and more, and I'm really looking forward to that. It puts a little more work back in our thing, because now instead of having one static layout that says here's what the machine looks like, it's like, well, yeah, but what does it look like from that side? Or what does it, like, if we're trying to do it as a situational awareness of knowing where the tablet actually is in the over, when you're looking at an overview, kind of doing a you are here type thing, we have to put more design into those screens to make it work that way.
For sure. I can remember commissioning a system, a complicated conveyor system in a food and bev site, and the HMI location got moved like late or during installation. And so all of our screens were now reversed. We were showing kind of it backwards from where the operator would be. And then we had to run, I'm running this conveyor line for, it was a distribution to do order merging and for shipping and loading orders into trucks. And man, was it confusing that everything was sort of opposite. I'm trying to touch one conveyor and I'm moving the wrong one compared to what I thought. So we had to flip the screens. But yeah, you got a point that, unless you just go top down and cheat on it, but you kind of need to make things line up with how the person's looking at it. Plus the screen size changed. I mean, that's another one. Everything is modern SCADA applications, and there's at least some, are supposed to be resizable, HTML5 adaptable, all that.
Yep.
But I'm always suspicious.
So they still sell those little 7-inch HMIs that I think every controls engineer despises.
Yeah, I mean, that's the OEM, right? I got to get what how How cheap can I go? And a space thing, I guess that's another. These tablets, you can have a fairly nice size display or decent display. The person's holding it fairly close, and then you're not having to put in a giant stainless steel panel that's slope top and all that cost.
And run theoretically, conduit. They don't need to be washed down because they can be put over in the office during washdown.
Yeah,
like they're not going to be on the floor during the washdown period.
Yeah, there's such a strong case for those. And then at the same time, there's a, if someone needs to run that machine and it's, are you seeing it for bonus things? Like, are you seeing it for machine control? Or are you seeing it just for bonus things like get me the manual and help me be a better operator, but I can still run over and touch something on the line that's built in that says stop start?
Most of the things I've seen have been on the bonus side of it. Okay. We have done one project where they were using tablets in like a production environment for it. There was still a terminal by, it was POU valves, like in a farm environment.
Yeah.
But they also had a tablet for the whole area where they could also do them from. So they had both ways, but there was still, and those point of use ones were tiny little screens. So the tablet actually gave them more real estate
much
to work
better
with.
Better screen.
But they did have a fixed one as well. It's for that exact reason, going, oh, the tablet's battery is dead. I gotta go charge it. How can I? You don't want to lose production because a tablet's got to be plugged.
Yeah, I can't reset the stack light's going red. I have no idea what it is. But hold on, I gotta go charge my tablet. Yeah, that's not a good story either. So okay, so more on the bonus side with the exception of where there's a garbage HMI that's, I guess, meets the bare minimum requirements, but the
one site where the supervisors are carrying them around, they have a cart where they, at the start of the shift, they grab one off of it, and it has charging stations that show the status of the batteries. So they grab a fully charged one, and if it dies before the end of shift, they go back over, swap it out, and when they log in, it takes them to where they're supposed. Into the areas they're supposed to be in.
So. I mean, people have been keeping radios going for maintenance and others
right. For
thousands of years, really. So we should, this is, shouldn't be.
Those tend to have swappable batteries, though, opposed
That's
to swapping
true.
The whole device out.
That's true.
But it's still, I mean, some radios don't, and you do swap out the whole radio, but it's still, it's one of those, it's manageable. It's just, you need to have a plan for it. What's it going to be, and keeping an eye on battery life and. Mm-hmm.
You see this virtual assistant, are you seeing or do you predict a kind of trend to, I know customer service and website stuff is moving to this bot thing almost, where there's a bot that says, hi, I'm the case packer and I'm having trouble with this fault. Can you come over or tells you, hey, would you like to see the CAD drawings for this? Or which
I can see it at some point. I don't see it in the single digit years yet for that, because we don't even have the ability to get a lot of that information to the operator manually right now, let alone trying to automate the whole way through it. So I think there's a lot of steps to go through to get there. At the rate that AI or bot type supports progressing, though, by the time we actually get that support on the floor, it might make sense to go straight to the bot, because it'll be that mature of a development by then. It won't be hard to implement.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, that would be. Go ahead.
I was going to say, just something, one more thing for controls engineers to have to stuff in their utility belt of things they have to know.
Bot programming. Oh, the bot. I mean, hopefully you're loading with text or something like that, or it's learning, I guess, on its own. We did pursue with a couple customers we talked about on our label verification side, troubleshooting kind of wizard or a troubleshooting menu. So you'd show images of five kind of things that can go wrong. It's something got dirty, camera got knocked out of position, it's out of focus, whatever kind of things that can prop up. And then you touch the one that you had, and then it would say, hey, here's what that problem means. Or you touch a fault, and then it has similar, it shows you pictures of it might be because of this. Is it because of this or this? You touch that one, and then, okay, well, here's what you need to do. Clean it or repoint it or something like that. And I know it's kind of surprising to me, and I don't know if it's because of budgets or I don't know if it's because automation projects work for capital engineering sometimes who kind of wants to put things in and then is moving on, Not all of them, of course. Not you, if you're listening. You're a good steward of the plant. You're a capital project engineer. But there's so many help things that get baked into software, but it's rare or not common to see it in automation stuff. There is no help that gives further details of what a fault means or recommended action. It's I've seen a few of them, but it's not a common to me in OEM equipment and lots of stuff. It's not some of them have it, but pretty rare.
Yeah, I'm one of the things I'm hopeful for with this trend, and that is getting rid of the tribal knowledge around each specific piece of equipment and pushing it more toward, oh, it's a photo eye issue here, and the tribal knowledge is about how a photo eye works, not how this specific photo eye is tied to this machine.
Yep.
So it's simplifying that level of entry, like that level of knowledge needed to be doing the troubleshooting, to ease the pain when your 25 or 30 year old veterans retire and now all of a sudden no one can keep a machine running, or it never had issues before because the guy knew exactly where to tap. And I joke about it, but I've seen people do that where it's like, it's making this funny noise, and the guy goes out and taps the machine a certain way, and it's like, yeah, it'll run for another 2 days now without making any noise.
And that's been a common theme from many guests, is turnover, institutional knowledge is going away. It leaves the company, walks out the door. It's hard to measure the impact of what that is. And then we're trying to use technology to improve that. And I wonder, maybe, I guess this is a good thing, or maybe you could look at it cynically that we the industry didn't do this as much before, but some of this is just good design and making things clearer. And maybe you don't need a cloud data lake, wireless 3D printing, tablet robots, because if you just named your faults better, so your alarm says this photo eye in this spot, as opposed to or server communication failed, instead of putting some confusing software name that no one knows what that means, put the name of the server in the fault. I don't know. There's stuff you can do with good design to really help.
I mean, discrete manufacturing, typically, like the first level alarms you have are just this proc switch didn't make.
Yeah. PX28.32 didn't fail to whatever. Yes.
Failed to close, failed. Whatever. Failed. Failed to open. And you're like, okay, you know, it's not even telling you which motion was trying to happen in order for that photo eye to fail. So now you're looking on the screen for the red dots and tracing them back and going, well, it's on this cylinder, and you're kind of digging through things where it's like, we need, and it kind of goes back to what we talked about before, data versus information. Like, we need to get troubleshooting information in their hand, not just data.
Yeah. And I'll say I'm as guilty for some of those as others going back. I mean, they don't let me touch the PLC code anymore, which is probably good for all of us at this point. But yeah, it's engineer design as opposed to engineer design for an operator, right? And hopefully Industry 4.0 really, whether we're all 3D printing everything with AI in the future or not, at least we're hopefully more operator focused and in our mindset of Industry 3.0 stuff we're building, if we are or for. Just another question, kind of, where do you see do you see this for plant managers too? We talked about operators, we talk about maintenance people, tablets. Where's the plant manager in this? Are they?
I do see it. It's one of the things that I hate the data lake that in previous iterations of this, where we just were like, we just need to pump everything up so everything's available. And then there's just too much, there's too much data and no information, where I think there still needs to be some idea of, okay, what is useful to the plant manager, the district manager that has multiple plants? What does the production manager need? What does the line supervisor need? Like, what are those each of those layer need? And that we need to get the information to them for what they need, and probably expand a little ancillary beyond it, just to kind of let them do a little digging, but do they need to know every fault that's going on the line? Probably not. Like that, they can investigate that through the other systems. Like they don't need that on their devices necessarily. Because right. Once again, it's like if you're just pushing all this information up, you know how it is. You have so much stuff on your phones already. Like if you just keep giving more and more and more, they're going to stop looking at what's important. And we need to keep the important stuff in front of everyone's face at all times. So what's going on?
I guess that's a question on all this, particularly again, tablet, but plant managers, operators. Do you see any signs of notification fatigue? Because I know I feel like I heard some story at a customer where they had integration with either text messaging or alarms or some app. Then operators message on it, maintenance message on it, and now it's escalating, which is kind of good, but kind of now all those people that this escalated to, the business unit manager, the supervisor, the plant manager, everyone is now calling that same maintenance guy to say, hey, how's it going? How you doing on this? What's the state of it? And it's like, are we pounding people excessively with notifications? And then because the people we're notifying are then going to call someone else who's going to then work on this? And have we hit overload on that? Do you think places how do you manage that?
I haven't seen enough of it implemented yet to see the overload. One of the projects I did back in the 90s was implementing a quality run stop system, you know, the pull chains along the line to where they can shut down the line. Well, now I'm really dating myself here, but we set up a system that when they pulled the pull chain, it would actually page the supervisor in the area with a alphanumeric pager and tell them which chain was pulled in their area and that the line was going to be stopping.
I was going to say pagers when you said 90s. Got to be like, hold on, my beeper is going beep beep. You know, you felt like you felt like an important person when your beeper went off in the night.
But even back then, people got notification fatigue. Like if they were having a quality issue in their area, they were just like, this thing's going off all day long because they were pulling the run stop that much. And it's like, it's not a new problem. It is something we need to address, because especially if you're doing email notifications, I mean, I'm sure you have it set up in your Outlook. If you have something that you get 20 notifications a day, what are you going to do? Create a little rule that puts it off in its own box that you check once a week.
Yes.
So that it defeats the whole purpose of those notifications.
And for those of you who didn't know about rules in Outlook, you have now just saved yourself countless hours, if not days of your life. Now, from this podcast, you heard it here on how to set up Outlook to disable those. I think one little piece, one trend, or I don't know if it's a trend, but new idea or wrinkle in this that I've seen customers use is Teams. So I think the advantage of Teams potentially for some of this notification is if a machine falls in the forest, does it make a Teams message? So if it makes a Teams message, now someone else can chat on that message and then say it is escalated to somebody else. At least they can look into it and see the history and see who said what about this. So there's kind of a conversation history on that thread or chat message or channel or whatever. So theoretically, someone can look into it. Okay, this escalated to me, but I see four people have said something about it and they're waiting on a part from somewhere that's coming in 4 hours. Okay, I don't need to pound into this as well, right? Whereas if it's
now in three and a half hours, if you're the production manager, you might want to call and go, are we still on? Is this thing still going to be here in a half hour? Like you might want to trigger you to set a notification for yourself to follow up on it when the time's appropriate, as opposed to being that guy looming over the controls engineer's head that's at the programming terminal go, when's it gonna run, when are we gonna be back up?
Actually, things do get fixed faster. There's like a law for this or something. The more people staring at you while you work, the faster you can go, and the fewer chances of you accidentally breaking something else. It's a known thing about programming or maintenance in general. So and that's a fallback of SMS, right? If you get an SMS, you have no clue who's done what or said what, or there's no information about any of it. And I know there's this sort of brings to more of a mass level. Some plants we put in these things where building automation system kind of stuff where you have a global alarm management system, and it's like a ticket gets created for each alarm and you can put notes on it and response history and escalate it and acknowledge it and mute it or shelve it. And then it is all that kind of piece, but that's maybe that comes now to, and you could just put one of those in, but Teams maybe lets you do that a little more without quite as much rigor and documentation and reporting, but maybe it's a bit faster, easier for just getting it in quickly and communicating amongst the team. But because you're not going to let everyone into your alarm management system to necessarily post chat, comment, so on. So no, good. That's an interesting one. So we talked a lot on some specific kind of detailed stuff, just big picture. What are you backing up a bit? What are people trying to solve with these new technologies, with all this information for an operator? What do you get out of it? What are some of the drivers of this? And
I look at it as one of the big things we're trying to fix with it is downtime, which is always a thing. And it's, and be like, well, how is getting operator information or technicians information solving downtime issues? And it's like, well, meantime to repair, if the information's at their fingertips, hopefully we can get that much shorter. Mm-hmm. I mean, theoretically, we could take these virtual assistants far enough that it's like this photo eyes failing. He goes out on the floor and he is like, yeah, this photo eyes failed, and hits, request. And by the time he gets to the storage crib, they've already retrieved it and have it waiting for him because the system set the request already into their maintenance crib to say, pull the part. Where he doesn't have to radio it in and hope he gets the right one because the system has which photo eye it is in the system, what's its stock number. And we could tie all those together, make it very quick. And once again, shortening our downtime windows.
Yeah. Finding those pieces of that chain in repair to improve and send information faster amongst the team to speed up some of those pieces. Or even you could just send it to Amazon and they could drone deliver you. Photo eye lands it to line and smashes through the skylight, and then you just have to plug it in and away you go. Interesting. I think it's a lot of the classic ones. I wonder, and here's, I'm not supposed to be cynical on a podcast. I think that's something in there about podcasts. How many companies are spending money on some of this stuff and then still not doing just basic maintenance? I mean, there's a one customer I knew of, and we struggle with them for funding on projects, and fine, so be it, priorities. But there was basic PMs like greasing belts and stuff like that they were having to skip or do at half the frequency they would want to do, kind of thing, because they were being squeezed. So I hope. Hopefully some of this is we're adding, but we're still doing the non-sexy basic maintenance that you need to just keep things spinning and going. And
even on the drawing on your cynicism and expanding it, even in the worst case scenario, okay, we have this conveyor, we've been automatically generating lubrication requests. The maintenance request been denied, skipped and all that, but that's in the system. And now we have a failure. Now do we have an argument to go back and go, we need to be doing these.
Yep.
And so if that means we need to hire an extra maintenance person for PMing or something, like, or we need to have schedule in a maintenance weekends or whatever, like, there's now a cost justification because we can actually say, hey, this conveyor is supposed to last so many thousand hours.
Yep.
It's failing a lot earlier, and hey, but we're not doing our maintenance on it. So,
I mean,
but this one over here, the way we did the maintenance on it, or did most of the maintenance on it, is still running just fine.
I mean, that'll be an interesting question because I don't know that many people are raising, and it should do this, and I would hope it do this, and the truth of what's going on, seeing more truth of what's going on somewhere is always a better thing, whether it's, maybe it makes some people look bad at times or make some decisions look bad, but hopefully, I mean, the data that comes out of all this may cut two ways. It may, some management it may point out the management who put it in, it may point at some of their other decisions and say, yeah, that's not a good decision that you've made there. And hopefully there's the courage and humility to use this to redirect in some points where kind of needed. But I don't know that, yeah, that's been raised as a, hey, this may make.
I'm just kind of hoping. I mean, I think we're all seeing the trend in the industry of hacking and slashing everything and doing everything, not putting investments into maintaining equipment, upgrading equipment, things like that, where it's like, we're going to run it till it dies and then we'll just replace it.
Mm-hmm. Which is a business model. I mean, you sometimes, yep. I guess that does make sense. Depends on your downtime cost, depends on your, I don't know, the lifespan of your product, and maybe no one's, it's, you don't want to see anyone do that. You don't want to see anyone do that, because we've been the guy who's called in a panic and has to go in there and put some bubble gum in the panel to get the thing going again. But but yeah, I guess you'll see that business case. The data will be there to say this makes sense or no. Hey, this run till failure model doesn't really work. It makes somebody's capital expense look good, but hey, we're taking a beating. I guess hopefully we'll see. And on that, so we're this is a great conversation, Doug, by the way, and I think really a pleasure to have some free time to go over kind of where things are moving with you. I'm going to kind of close with two questions. So question from an earlier guest, how do you find the right balance between centralized and decentralized digital transformation?
I think I'm going to go back a little bit to what I was saying, is knowing what the user is looking for. And that user might be your CEO. It might be a plant manager. It might be regional manager. It might be your supervisor. Like, kind of just saying, oh, we're going to decentralize our information or we're going to centralize it all to corporate. It's like, does corporate need that information? Because it's one of those, if we have to generate it in the plant and push to the cloud anyway, does it make sense pushing something to the cloud that doesn't, no one that has access to the cloud really wants or is going to use, or it's just going to get lost in the weeds where they're going to be digging through things that looking for data, I mean, looking for things when it's not really what their job's about. So, I mean, I look at it as what does the user need? And like I said, the users can be anything, and then deciding where does it make sense to draw that, what should be decentralized versus centralized, and going from there. And it's case by case. Some plants might be, hey, the CEO wants full visibility down to the floor. It's like, well, now at some point you got to have everything centralized so he can get to it, like, or at least available for him to drill into the plants themselves if it is staying decentralized.
Right. And I think to your point, it's a corporate culture piece too, right? That different companies run super lean on corporate. So there's no point in putting much for them because there's the two people that work at corporate kind of thing. And it's just the sites run their own show, and there's no corporate person kind of driving accountability at the lower level, let's say, that wouldn't drill in at the lower level versus other companies with a stronger corporate piece. So I think good point. It's really subject to case by case. What are the kinds of information? What are the kinds of digital transformation we're talking about? Who would consume it? And what's the corporate culture and structure of the company to accept that or not?
I mean, we even have the standpoint of, I mean, I think we've all been in the middle of nowhere effectively standing in a cornfield that has a plant in the middle of it. And it's, oh, they have a really bad internet connection. I mean, right. I know we have some customers overseas where they have really bad connections between their plants and they're even on the same campus. And it's like, mm-hmm. Do you really want to be relying on everything being centralized when it could be down for days at a time?
Right. What's realistic, right? Is there a question that you'd like to another guest, the next guest, to ask? What in 4.0 question would you like answered?
I'm actually stealing it from stealing the idea from it from one of my managers over the years. Was the, if you have a magic wand and could change anything, what would you change about Industry 4.0?
All right, and we'll ask that. Leveraging, I think leveraging is a better word, more positive word than stealing. You're leveraging, right? to increase your degree of force based on your distance from the fulcrum, if I got that part right. Well, Doug, yep. Thank you very much. This has been a great conversation. Hope our guests have learned something. I know I have. And again, thank you for coming.
And thank you, Dave, for having me.
Awesome. So thanks for joining us, everybody listening on the Industry 4.0 podcast with Grantech. Please do hit subscribe. If you have any questions or feedback or thoughts, email to info@grantech.com. And hope you can join us again next time. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.